You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Lizzie, this is normally quite a very simple question, but today it feels quite complex. Where are you?
Oh my God.
How the hell did you get there?
Do you want the long answer or the short answer? Well, hello, Tom. Nice to see you as well this month. But the answer to your question is I'm in Girona and I arrived here 2 days ago. And for the Brits who are listening to this, you will probably know that that was the day that the Spanish border closed. And then I arrived into France the day before that, which was the day that the French border closed. So, yeah, I'm actually down in Girona for a training camp. I was supposed to be on my team training camp right now and actually coming back from that today. And that was cancelled because of the COVID situation in Italy. So my husband and I decided that we were going to drive to Girona for our own training camp over Christmas and New Year. And we were going to drive in order to, you know, minimise any risks to both us and to other people should we be infected and not know. And thankfully, we booked our Channel Tunnel for Sunday evening. And we were in the queue for the Channel Tunnel and my husband was getting a bit jumpy. And I said, Gabriel, what's the matter? There's no way they're going to close the border. And we actually stayed with Richard that night and we arrived at Richard's a couple of hours drive from Calais, and he opened the door and he said, they're closing the border in 2 hours. Then the next day we started driving to Spain, and the plan had been to stop for a ride somewhere in France, but it was absolutely throwing it down. So we just carried on kind of hoping that the weather would dry up and I'd get a ride in, and it just didn't. So I thought, oh, sod it. I'm not meant to ride today. And we carried on, and it was a long way to Spain. And we kind of thought, should we stay somewhere in France? Should we not? So Gabriel had a quick look at the news, and then it said, the Spanish border's closing tomorrow. So we just drove all the way to Girona, and now we're here, and we may never leave. We may never be able to come back to the UK, but you know what? It's pretty nice here. It's fine.
Well, I actually saw you on Sunday, we were doing the cycling podcast. We were doing this 12-hour turbo thing called Cranked Up, and I actually saw you were at Richard's house, and my offer that I made then still stands. If you need anyone to go around and feed the cats, that stands. Okay,
well, yeah, who knows what the British government's going to decide to do in the next 2 weeks, so I may well take you up on that offer, Tom. We may have had that decision to whether or not we should move abroad taken out of our hands, and we may just be in Spain forever now.
Well, Lizzie, let's crack on. Actually, no, before we crack on, I've got to ask you, there's one really pressing question that I've got to ask, and that is, are you going to be the National Hill Climb Champion next year?
Well, it has just been announced that the 2021 National Hill Climb Championships will be taking place at Winnetts Pass, which is in my backyard, but you know, I've got the excuses coming thick and fast. Not only is it off season, it's actually the day after my husband's best friend's wedding. So I don't know. It would be a pretty cool one to go and do, but it probably doesn't really fit with the calendar, unfortunately. But I'm definitely going to go and watch. Whatever happens, I will go and watch, because that is going to be one hell of a spectacle at Winnetts Pass.
I mean, I can't think in this country, I mean, I've not ridden everywhere, but I can't think of a better place to watch a bike race, just because the views you get from anywhere on that pass, from the cliffs on either side, will be just epic.
Yeah, the photography coming out of that event is going to be absolutely stunning. And also, there's not that many climbs where you can stand on the climb and see kind of nearly the whole climb. And actually, if you stand on one of the cliff tops going up the side of Winnetts Pass, you know, Google it if you don't know what it's like, because it really is stunning. You can see the whole way up, and I think they said on the press release that the steepest bit was 17-18%, but that is rubbish. It is so much steeper than that. It is, I don't know, well over 20 for a while, and it is absolutely savage. I mean, it's definitely one of the hardest climbs in the country.
Well, I'm going to work on it for the rest of the year, try and persuade you to take part. I won't be taking part for definite.
You could do it on a single speed, Tom.
I could do it, you know, yeah, well, I've got pedigree on single speed. And actually,
it's actually a good climb for a single speed, you know.
You could be right, actually, or maybe I'll have a word with someone before it and get myself set up. But that actually leads me on to what we're doing today. So it's a bit of a press conference episode, this Christmas episode. You know, we've opened up the floor to your questions. And in terms of my expertise, I'm probably only qualified to answer questions about the sort of jean shorts you should be wearing on a fixie. But luckily, you're here and we've got a whole other host of experts to answer questions as well. Should we get started with the first question, Lizzie?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, make sure you listen through to the end of the show, because we've got an amazing interview with Cameron Mason, the young up-and-coming cyclocross star, and he's just brilliant. So do listen to that. But yeah, let's go straight to our first question.
Hi, Lizzie, it's Hannah here. I was hoping you could tell me what you'd recommend for fueling on bike rides over Christmas. Christmas cake or mince pies? Thanks.
Well, Tom, you said you didn't have any expertise in this area, but I think this is probably the question for you. What do you think then? Christmas cake or mince pies?
This is not a technical answer, but I prefer mince pies to Christmas cake a million times over. Also, I think they're a bit more portable, maybe.
On the bike. You know what? This is actually an interesting question, because after Christmas every year, I go to the shop and I buy loads of the reduced Christmas cakes, because they are absolutely incredible bike food. They're quite dense, they're very calorie rich, really, really high in carbohydrate, relatively low in fat, delicious. They're pretty much the perfect bike snack. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love a mince pie, but I'm not really sure an on-bike mince pie is going to go down very well. And it's not really back pocket food. It's definitely going to fall apart. I mean, okay, maybe you say mince pies, Tom, but my vote is with the Christmas cake.
Hi, this is Dan from York. I currently commute on my giant road bike, as I felt my Cannondale Bad Boy was a little too sluggish for the distance and a bit cumbersome, even for the back roads. It currently has wide slick tyres. Whilst I have no issue plying through the mostly awful northern autumn and winter weather and potholed and rather muddy terrain on the full carbon giant, it's a rather hard ride to say the least. Would you recommend a cyclocross bike perhaps, or maybe swapping the Bad Boy wide slicks for something more cyclocross like? That would be tyres and wheels. Also, a recommendation for a great pair of winter riding gloves would be awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, Lizzie, I can tackle this one as well a little bit. I would say...
Are you just going to tell him to go and buy another bike?
Yeah, get yourself a new bike. But I've got to say... because
that's not a solution, Tom. Just buy another bike.
I've had this issue. I've had this issue myself with... my winter bike. I tended to use my cross bike on the road over winter. I commute on it quite a lot as well, and you know, it is noticeably with those grippy knobbly tyres, it is noticeably sluggish. But you know, once I turned it into my all-round adventure bike, I put on a set of gravel tyres which have essentially down the middle. They have like just essentially it's like a road tyre down the middle. There's a thin strip, so if you're riding in a straight line on a good road, it's noticeably quicker. So I would go for the new bike with the sort of do it all tyres is what I would recommend.
That's exactly it. I mean, if you don't have space or money for one more bike in the house, then instead of having the road bike, you could have this adventure type bike with wider clearance and then two sets of tyres and wheels, and you can have one set of tyres, like Tom says, with the slick bit in the middle and the knobbly bits on the side. So if you're on the road, it's great. But if you want to go off and do cyclocross stuff, great too. But you can also then just whack another set of tyres and wheels in. And, you know, cost-wise, it's relatively cost-effective to just get another set of tyres and wheels, especially compared to buying another full bike. So that's probably a good answer. Well, what about winter gloves then, Tom? Have you got any recommendations? I know it's really a hard one, and I would say I probably have 5 or 6 different pairs of winter gloves for different conditions, both temperature-wise and weather-wise, and how wet it is.
With winter gloves, I've got to say, I'm a fan of improvising. So... what I've used before successfully in the past is those Thinchulet, they're not even a cycling glove, but you know the Thinchulet inserts you get to put in gloves. Use those and layer up. I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of just adapting regular good winter gloves. But when it comes to stuff that is waterproof, then there's no messing. So I would always, my go-to is, the brand is Castelli. So any of the sort of neoprene gloves that they do, big fan. And I mean, I haven't ridden out on the road much this year, but normally I would be in those. I'm quite late to get the winter gloves out. I can tolerate it quite a lot. So I would be using the sort of the wet gloves, which I can probably, they keep you warm enough during autumn and early winter. And I'd ride those for a very long time before I then maybe, you know, I even layer those up with another pair of like Thinsulate gloves over the top sometimes.
I agree with you about neoprene. So we had a pair from Endura, which was a full neoprene pair, a bit like a wetsuit pair. And I think Castelli make a pair that are really similar too. And those are really great for wet weather, as long as you've got good enough circulation. The problem is, if you've got rubbish circulation, then you can't, you know, they rely on you, your body getting them to a certain level of warmth, and then, you know, then it holds the warmth. But if you've got Raynaud's or something, you know, problems with your circulation, then they're probably not the ones for you. My husband actually has this problem, and he uses a really cheap pair of what we call claws. So you've got your thumb hole and then yes, your first two yes, fingers yes. and the next two fingers. And he just buys them from Planet X. You know, they're not the world's best quality, best manufactured glove, but they are, you know, they really do the job for winter riding. And, you know, they're, I think they're 10 or 15 pounds or something, and they've really lasted him a long time. And so I would say, if you got really cold hands, those are great. But when it comes to really cold and really wet, a fully waterproof glove, Gore-Tex, something like Sealskins, you know, some, or something with a Gore-Tex lining, you know, you've really got to go for that. And like I said, yeah, I've got a thin pair, I've got a neoprene pair, I've got the winter cold but dry, the winter cold but wet pair. And I think you just need a whole wardrobe of gloves, but neoprene are great, full waterproof are great, and then have a thin pair for those kind of spring days, autumn days when you know, you're not quite sure but you need something in between. And I've got a Katusha pair for those, which are great.
Hi, this is Brian from Edinburgh. My question is, every time I upload a ride from Garmin to Strava, it drops the average speed. Can you explain why this is?
That, do you know what, this, I've noticed this. Normally it's only by 0.1 or 0.2 for me with ride uploads. Doesn't concern me anymore because I just do all my riding indoors. So Lizzie, you tackle this one.
Well, it's a pretty easy one, really. It's just about the fact that the moving time and the elapsed time is measured slightly differently on your Garmin and on Strava. And if, you know, Garmin's auto-pausing for slightly longer than Strava thinks is correct, then when you upload it to Strava, the time, you know, the speed will go down a little bit. And it's really as simple as that.
So really, ride faster and then the drop-off shouldn't affect you as much.
Never,
right?
Never stop. Don't stop riding. Never start stop. Your ride. Don't stop, and then stop your ride, and then it should be exactly the same. Or just ride indoors. Then you don't have that problem because you don't go anywhere.
Hi, my name's Chris from Manchester, and my tech question is: I always find it terrifying to think about servicing and re-greasing my bearings, specifically my rear hub and my bottom bracket. Have you got any advice on how not to mess it up and how to make it seem less terrifying?
Well, thanks for your question, Chris. And I actually hate servicing bottom brackets and rear hubs. I never do it. It is the devil's work. It really, really is. Anyway, I know someone who's very, very good at it. So I threw this question over to Alan Sheldon, who's been my team mechanic for the last 2 years.
Every hub, you know, because of different manufacturers, every hub and bearing setup will be different. So what we do as pro mechanics, when we come across a situation like that that we haven't tackled before, we actually take photographs as we disassemble the item. So if it was bearings that we haven't worked on, we'll take a photograph at the beginning, and we'll complete a stage, take a photograph of that, do the next stage, take a photograph of that. So especially with bearings, if you're taking them apart and you're taking the seals off, take a photograph with the seal off, you know, then you know the layout as the manufacturer wanted it. And then you just follow the photographs in reverse order all the way back and rebuild it. That's the easiest way.
I've also found, well, I say I actually do almost all the mechanics in my house, and my husband does all of the rear hub mechanics. I don't know why, it's a funny balance, but it seems to work. But he's found as well, and I'm sure you'll vouch for this, that every single rear hub is different.
Yeah. Because also certain manufacturers will have patents on certain items. So one manufacturer will have one way of doing it, and then of course the other manufacturer can't copy that way of doing it, so they'll have to do it a different way. So everybody will have slightly different.
So I guess the golden rule is take your time, take photos, and then, I mean, is there any particular type of grease that you should use?
We tend to use high-speed grease on bearings, just because they, especially on hubs, wheel hubs, because they'll be rotated. So you've got
What is that, and where would you find it?
So it's readily available in, like, in the UK. A team I used to work for in the UK, we were sponsored by Fenix. Fenix do a high-speed grease, which is in a tube with a really good nozzle on the end. So you can just cut that and you just make it large enough to just literally do all the bearings. They do all types of different ones, you know, so you can, you know, assembly greases, carbon, you know, based ones, you get silicon ones, all different ones. And the high speed in particular is very good for bearings which are going to be going at, you know, fast rates, so hub bearings. So you would use a different grease for the bearings on your bottom bracket because they don't, they're not rotating as fast.
Interesting. They are rotating quite fast, though. I guess, yeah, 90 RPM as opposed to a lot more. So what grease would you use on a bottom bracket? Medium speed speed grease.
You can get all different types of ones. And it's generally, when you're taking the bearings apart, you want to see what the actual, you know, manufacturer, when they put them together, what kind of grease they used. So when we were, you know, at Bigler, because we were with Ceramic Speed, Ceramic Speed, you know, do all their own greases. So that's what they recommend for their bottom bracket hubs, you know, bottom bracket bearings, etc. So, but because we were with Ceramic Speed, they never wore right, so we didn't have to do any maintenance on them.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks as ever to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast and Service Course and a lot of the other things that we do here. If you want to get 25% off your next order with Science in Sport, which of course you do, especially seeing as they have that range just dedicated to indoor training, which we're all going to be doing a lot of, just enter the offer code SISCP25. Go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code SISCP25.
Hello Lizzie, hello Tom. It's Paul from North Yorkshire here, and it's a question about pro cycling technology that just intrigues me. With such a focus on marginal gains and such a wealth of communication technology on the planet nowadays, race radios just seem such an anachronism. We see people taking their hands off the bars to be able to speak, having to rip earpieces out of their ears, and with matchbox-sized lumps in the back of their skin suit to make the technology happen at all. So I'd be really interested in any insights you have from the Peloton, and any views on how you see this developing over the next few years. Thanks very much. Bye.
Do you know what? This crops up all the time. I remember I sat down with Joe Dombrowski once to talk about race radios, and I just said, I've only ever heard pros moaning about their race radios all the time, constantly moaning about it. And, you know, the idea, you know, if someone could come up with a foolproof, a better race radio, that everyone would just buy it. Everyone would adopt it. In your experience, Lizzie, are race radios pretty unreliable, pretty bad?
They're terrible. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing how bad they are, but they are absolutely terrible. They go wrong all the time. We've, you know, the number of times you go back to the car and then a radio has been dropped outside of the car and then been run over and then just gone to very, yeah, radio heaven. Yeah. We actually had a bit of a saga with our radios this year. So we'd had really old radios in the team that were really unreliable. And, you know, every late race, at least one person would maybe be able to hear three of the riders, but not three of the other riders. And they'd be able to hear the DS, but the DS wouldn't be able to hear them, or something ridiculous. So my director was like, right, screw this. It's a big investment, but we are going to get new race radios. So on the restart of the season, we had all these fancy new radios and we were racing Strada and Neve's radio wouldn't work. And then she went back to the car, she got another radio, it worked for 5 minutes and stopped working. And then every race, like it, some of us, you know, we'd do the radio check and they would work and then they would just stop working. And then we'd turn them on at the end and they would be fine and charged and we couldn't work out what was wrong. And so the way the radios work is you all tune into the same channel and then you lock them so that you can't change the channel whilst the race is going on. But with these radios, for some reason, the on-off button wasn't locked, so that when you were racing, your radio is in a pocket in the back of your shorts, but if you put your hand in your back pocket in order to get some snacks out, the girls were actually turning their radios off without realising. And then obviously they stopped working, but we had no idea why. And it took us like 4 or 5 races to work out what was going on. And we'd just be like going back and forth to the car. So yeah, I mean, what a stupid design. But I don't know. I mean, my theory as to why they're so rubbish is just that it's because it's such a small market. And so, you know, why would you put loads of development into something that is an expensive product with a really, you know, limited capacity for numbers of people buying it? But yeah, they are mind-blowingly rubbish. And if you think that they cost the same as a smartphone and everything that a smartphone can do, and all these things have to do is just transmit information back and forth, I do not know why they say rubbish. So I'm sorry, Paul, I did not answer your question, but yeah, race radios are crap.
I do want to do an episode on race radios. I've been trying to solve this problem in my head for ages, like how I can capture the audio going to and from a rider's race radio. And when I solve it in a way that, I mean, I could solve it, but you'd have to carry one of these big heavy Zoom packs with you, which I don't think you want to do when you're racing. But when I can solve that problem, I'm going to give you a device and we're going to record your race radio for a race. That is a promise.
I think what people listening don't realise as well is how bad race radio is. So sometimes you hear snippets of snippets of kind of recordings from inside cars and stuff as well, but it's often impossible to hear what people are saying. And, you know, often, you know, your teammates are from all different countries, and sometimes we have problems understanding each other at the best of times just when we're sitting at the dinner table. Now imagine that into a radio, and you're trying to understand somebody speaking foreign English and they're trying to understand you, and maybe I'm speaking too fast because I'm just speaking my own language and they're trying to understand it, and then the car is trying to decipher what's going on, and it's stressful. And oh my god, I remember actually in the Giro there was one day where we were going down this hill at 100 kph, and my director was just talking to me like, Lizzie, can you tell me the situation, blah blah blah, and I just calmly said into the radio, it's a bit fast, Thomas, please can we speak later? And then put the radio down. But yeah, honestly, race radios, just, it's quite funny thinking back to it now, but the amount of stress they have caused, just unimaginable.
Hi, this is Georg from Germany. I have a quick question because I'm wondering for ages now already. Everybody seems to get obsessed about the sound of the freewheel hub, and I was wondering if that really makes a difference for the performance of the hub, or if it's a pure aesthetic thing that people are discussing there.
So, some make more noise than others. It's generally down to how many pores are actually in the freewheel, in the free hub. So the pores are generally what they used to be, and different manufacturers have different ways of doing it, but on various ones I've taken apart over the years, they are actually small springs with a small piece of metal, and how many of those, that's called a pour, how many of those are in each hub? Again, depends on the manufacturer. So the more pours you have, the more instances you have of contact. So in theory, whenever you stamp on the pedals, you're immediately gonna, you know, the more pours you've got, you'll get more drive immediately, because there's less space between each pour, so you're going to get more drive. So if you get a hub which has got a lot of ticking, you've got more pours.
Well, Georg also had another very interesting question about carbon wheel sets.
I am considering to upgrade my wheel set to a carbon wheel set. However, I don't want to spend thousands and thousands of euros on it. So I'm considering to buy a Chinese-made wheel set from a Chinese-based company. And I've read, you know, great reviews about the products. I'm wondering what your perspective is on getting a Chinese-branded wheel set rather than one of the established European or Western American companies.
Well, look, I mean, the Chinese carbon wheel market, I have seen some horrific examples of wheels failing. I've got to say, I have had a really good experience. A friend of mine is a wheel builder, and he did a lot of research and found a factory in China that whose wheels he really rated, and they were cheap. He actually supplied me with a couple of sets that I have ridden for a long time. I don't blow my trumpet, but I actually won a couple of races on his wheel sets, and they were great.
Wow, the wheels must have been really, really good. Did they have motors?
The wheels must have been really good. That's right. They were super good. But I mean, I would never personally go out and just buy my own set off eBay or whatever, but with a trusted wheel builder who's built this relationship and knows what they're talking about, who's perhaps even been out there to see the factories, because a lot of these factories, they might be making wheel sets for brands at the same time. They're just doing something else on the side. So that's my own personal experience anyway.
I'd agree with you, Tom, and you know, there's so many connotations to kind of Chinese carbon, and you kind of think, oh, it's rubbish, but Chinese, Taiwanese, whatever, you know, that's where all the best products are made, and you've just got to get the right factory and a reliable product. And I was going to say exactly the same thing about finding a wheel builder. So Zed Wheels, who are based in Barnsley, who we spoke to last year, who make the Dyneema string spoke wheels, like the lightest set of wheels in the world, I can't remember exactly where he said he gets his wheels from, whether it's Taiwan or whether it's China, but he has a trusted supplier who he uses, and the wheels are fantastic. So if you're not sure, then go through a wheel builder like that. And to be honest, with Zed Wheels, you know, you're going to be really hard pushed to find a cheaper set of wheels anyway. And the quality is amazing, because, you know, the thing that I think people don't realise is how important the build of the wheel is to the quality of the wheel. Obviously, you need a good rim, but having somebody who really knows how to build a wheel is so important. We've had wheel sets, just cheap ones from Campag or wherever, that we've ordered from Wiggle, and they've arrived and they've not even been straight, and they've literally just been thrown together. So if somebody actually puts these wheels together with care and attention, I'd say that's one of the most important things. So really do your research, and if it's really well rated, then it's probably going to be fine. But yeah, I would say research is the most important thing with that.
Well, I should plug my mate. I've just Googled him, just check he's still building wheels. And his brand is called 23 millimeters, so 23mm. So look him up. It's Mike. Tell him I sent you. He's very good.
And Lee from Zed Wheels, tell him I sent you as well.
Hi, I'm Kerry, and I have two questions for you. Firstly, is there any merit in buying women's specific geometry bikes, or is it just as good to buy a men's frame and build it up with specific components, such as shorter stem, narrow handlebars, and women's specific saddle? And secondly, what crank length do women in the pro peloton tend to ride? Thanks.
So I'm currently out here in Girona training, and I'm with my teammate from 2020, Nia Fisher-Black, who is also the 2020 Kiwi national champion and also happens to be a pint-sized, very petite lady. So she is the perfect person to help answer me help me answer this question. So, Niamh, what do you think about women-specific bikes?
Personally, I don't like them. I'm all for the men's bikes, the racy bikes, the good-looking bikes.
She actually said before this, she said, I think they're stupid. And I said, yeah, I agree. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Yes, yes, I admit, I did say, I think they are stupid. I've always leaned towards the men's bikes and making it all I can do to make a men's frame work for me. And yeah, I think that's the pitfall of women's bikes is that they're making up for the smaller sizes for smaller women, but why not just make smaller sizes of the men's bikes?
Yeah, I mean, so when I say that, yeah, I think they're also stupid, I should clarify that by saying I just don't think that there needs to be a specific bike for a woman. So Niamh was telling me before when she was on a team that it was a sponsored team and everybody was choosing the women's specific bike. And she said, well, actually, no, I don't want that one because I can't get into the race position that I want because this women's specific bike is set up in a much more relaxed position than the male or unisex bike frames. And, you know, over the last or this year and next year, you're going to be on Specialized. This year, you've been on Chapter 2. Both these years, you've been on essentially men's frames, but you've been able to find a frame size that fits you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yeah, maybe I've pushed it a little bit. I've always been using short stems, narrow handlebars, doing everything I can to be as low as possible and make the frame fit. And I mean, it's doable. Like, I'm very definitely one of the smaller riders in the peloton, and I'm around 160 centimetres tall. So, I'm very much one of the smaller women, and I make it work with the smallest men's bikes. So, yeah, it's doable.
What crank length do you ride then, Niamh?
I ride 160 millimetre cranks.
So that is probably one of the smaller cranks that you're going to see knocking around, isn't it?
Yes, I don't see very many other women or anyone on 160 millimetre cranks.
No, you were the only one in our team that was riding it. But 165 was actually pretty common in our team. And a few years ago when I was on Story Racing, my domestic team, I remember back then they had some people on it, but it wasn't really commonplace. And I think it is becoming more and more common as more women get on bikes and people are realising that, no, maybe we shouldn't put 172.5 cranks on everybody's bikes. And like you said before, you know, you say sometimes you go into a bike shop and you see a small size frame and it's got massive cranks on it, and it just seems so counterintuitive.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really passionate. I just don't understand why small women would run long cranks. It's just a tall man, yeah, he runs 170s, but then there's a woman that's like, yeah, a couple of feet shorter than this man, and she's running the same size cranks. Like, it doesn't make sense proportionally to the leg length.
Yeah, so I think probably both of our advice would be, if you want a bike that is women specific, or if you want a bike and it just so happens that the bike that works for you, for the style of riding, your size, if that's women specific, go for it. Don't let the fact that it's women specific stop you from buying it. But I think there's no reason not to look at men's, in inverted commas, bikes, or really just unisex bikes, because I've always ridden a unisex bike, you've always ridden a unisex bike, and yeah, you know, get the frame and then build it up, and that's actually always the best way to make your bike, really. It's cheaper, you get it exactly the spec that you want, get those narrow handlebars, get those shorter cranks, get that saddle that fits you, and whether that's women specific or not, it doesn't really matter. Women specific is really kind of, it's just an advertising logo, because it may be better for women. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to fit all women.
Hi, Tom and Lizzie. It's Tristan in Paris. I have a question for you about Mark Hershey and his use of his bike computer mount as a set of improvised tri-bars. He did this, and I'm not the only person who noticed it, at the Tour de France in his various breakaways. And I really noticed it because he was kind of really putting a lot of weight and leverage on his bike computer mount. And I wondered if you thought that this was something that was being done intentionally, maybe by the bike computer mount manufacturer or the bike frame manufacturer, as a kind of workaround to get around UCI rules on handlebar construction, etc., or whether you think it was just something that Mark Hershey has picked up along the way as a kind of habit, either or even on the spur of the moment. I wonder what your thoughts were on that. And also whether or not there were any other similar hacks that riders used, using standard equipment to get around rules on bike setup and construction. Thanks very much.
Well, the way Mark Hershey was riding the Tour is something that we actually see pretty often when riders are out front or, you know, in a breakaway. We also saw Andre Amador doing this a lot in the Vuelta. And actually, there was quite a lot of chat about how unsafe it was to kind of be riding with, you ride with your elbows on the handlebars and kind of your hands in the middle. So you're kind of replicating a time trial position, but you don't have anything to hold on to. And so with Mark Hershey's, he was putting his hands onto his computer mount, which kind of makes it look like he's resting on the computer mount. But really, where he's resting is going to be on the handlebars. And that's really no different to the way that Amador was riding. That's my opinion on it anyway. You know, it is something that riders do when they're out front to kind of be as aero as possible and reduce the drag as much as possible. And, you know, it is pretty safe. People kind of, yeah, lambast us for doing it, but it's fine.
It's a case of knowing when to do it for me, really. I mean, the thing is, pros do this sort of stuff and then it does trickle down. I mean, I've been in races in the bunch where, you know, you've looked to your right and someone is copying the way the pro rides with their, you know, I've seen people in that sort of Chris Froome low position, you know, as they're descending, or people with their hands in their sort of puppy paws draped over the Garmin mount. And it's fine if you're a pro and if you're out on your own, you know, out front. But if you're in a bunch with me on an open road,
Don't do it. Yeah. I mean, the number of people I've been on a ride with who've been descending on their top tube and I've just said, don't do that. I'm not going to ride with you if you do that. Like, what's the point? Don't take the risk. I don't want you to crash. And even more, if you crash, I don't want to crash. That's really annoying. So yeah, basically, don't be a...
This is Stephen from Edinburgh. I'd like to know why my disc brakes squeal after going through a puddle, given my car brakes don't. Why don't Dura-Ace make a bigger cassette? I'd like an 11-34 cassette. 30 appears to be their biggest.
Okay, Stephen. So first of all, I'm going to answer your 11-34 cassette. Why don't Dura-Ace make one? Well, Altegra do. And so do you need a Dura-Ace cassette? No, not really. Just go and buy the Altegra one. And why do your disc brakes squeal when going through a puddle on your bike? Well, really, I think with a car, the disc brakes are actually hidden and they're kind of housed, so they don't get rubbish all over them like they do with the ones on the bike. You know, if you go through a puddle, you're going to get water on them, mud on them, maybe bits of oil, maybe even bits of grit. And if there's any misalignment from that grit, that vibration of the disc brake against the frame, or you know, the kind of slight misalignment of the wheel, is going to cause it to absolutely howl.
Okay, so we're going to have a couple of questions now on tubeless tyres.
So I didn't feel like I was the best person to answer these questions about tubeless tyres. So I thought I'd put these to Cameron Mason, but we also spoke about so much more. So I thought I'd just run the full interview for you because it's absolutely great.
I really want to move to tubeless tyres, but I'm put off as friends have been left stranded with a tubeless puncture that's too large to seal. They run into problems trying to get a tube into the tubeless tyre and end up having to get a lift home, which defeats the purpose of the tubeless tyre.
Hello, my name's Richard from France, hence the French accent. My question is about tyres and tyre widths and tyre pressures. When I got a new road bike last year, it came with 28mm tyres. And when I used to ride a bike more seriously way back in the previous millennium, we were aiming for, you know, 18mm, 20mm tyres. And I thought it would feel like a tractor, but I really, really like them. They give a much more comfortable and less harsh ride. What should I be running? What pressure should I be running these thicker tyres? I read somewhere that they should be at lower pressures. Is that correct? Can you recommend an ideal pressure for 28 mil tyres. And if I like 28 mil tyres, would 32 mil tyres feel even better? Or am I in the sweet spot just now? I also wondered what you both used and what you liked, clinchers, tubeless or tubulars. I'm particularly curious about tubeless, in particular whether you've tried them, what you think, and do they help solve the perennial problem of punctures? Thank you.
Well, Cameron, congratulations on your bronze medal at the European Championships, but unfortunately your season went a little bit of an unexpected direction straight after that, didn't it?
Yeah, so I had a a very good ride at Euros, I think, and then the momentum was carried on for that and then stopped very quickly when I crashed in the sand in Merckx Plus about a month ago now, and I fell just in the perfect wrong place and broke my collarbone. So yeah, definitely wasn't ideal, but the kind of aftermath of that was, yeah, I got surgery the night of it and went home for a few weeks, and then now I'm in Girona training, which is lovely and I'm very grateful for, and I'm building up basically for World Championships towards the end of my cross season. So yeah, it changed things a little bit, but overall I'm still heading in the right direction, so yeah, things are all good.
How's it been for you watching your Trinity Racing teammate Tom winning, you know, Super Prestige and Gavere and Thomas Mein as well, you know, compatriot in the top 10? You know, how does that feel for you when you obviously had such excellent form in the Euros and coming into this cyclocross season? Are you able to kind of enjoy their successes, or is it really difficult for you having to watch that from the sofa?
I didn't really enjoy it at the start, obviously, and I think that was the main reason to go home and just kind of switch off from all that stuff, really, as my collarbone's healing. But now I'm out doing my own thing, I think I'm able to kind of separate it quite well. Like, they're doing what they're doing at the moment, and I'm doing what I'm doing at the moment, which is trying to build up my level and come back stronger. So I watched all the racing at Namur, and I'm sure a few of the listeners will have watched that one as well. It was, yeah, spectacular racing in the men's and the women's, and it makes me just really like the sport even more as a viewer. I'm not bad at watching on TV as well.
I'd say for the Brits as well, you know, there's just such a strong contingent of young, strong British riders. You know, you, Thomas Mein, Ben Tellet, Anna Kay, Hattie Harden, even Evie Richards, Tom Pidcock, you know, the list could go on. And watching all this talent is really exciting and hopefully inspiring the next generation of cyclocross riders as well. But so we're here to talk tech today. First of all, can you run me through what your setup is for your team bike with Trinity Racing for the cyclocross season?
Yeah, so we're on Specialized S-Works Cruxes. We have three of them at the race, which sounds a bit ridiculous, but those bikes really do get used from practice to warm up. And then in the race, in muddy races, you need as much equipment as possible. So we have three of everything, basically. We run Challenge tyres, which are a tubular tyre glued onto the rim, and then SRAM, and then Zip componentry for everything else. We run mountain bike pedals, and everything else is pretty much road componentry apart from the tyres. So that's your kind of overview of a cyclocross bike.
Is that a 1x setup?
Yeah, we run the 1x12, but the Shimano riders run the 2x11. It's sometimes a little bit of a... Yeah, some courses would require more gear, some less. But for the most part, you run what you've run, and you can, yeah, if you commit to one setup, then it will do you just fine for the whole season.
And with your tyre choice, do you always go with tubular, or do you ever go down the tubeless line?
So for racing, it's pretty much 100% tubular. Some of the American riders have run tubeless at high level, and also it's very normal to run tubeless tyres in a regional race, and I ran tubeless tyres for years as well. They're a little bit more cost effective because you can change tyres really easy on a race weekend, so instead of having three sets of wheels for three different treads of tyres, you only need one set of wheels and then three sets of tyres, which still sounds like a lot, but it's a lot more doable, and you can as well change the tyres on race day as well. So that's definitely a benefit of tubeless over tubular. But then with the tubular tyres, the real benefit is that they're glued to the rim. So it allows you to run really low pressures and maximise grip. So
often we can run as low as 16-17 psi, which is basically like riding around on the rim. It's incredibly flat, but that just gives you the maximum grip on those muddy courses, and that's something you can't quite do with the tubeless tires, because you'll risk burping the tubeless, which is when it kind of comes away from the rim and a little bit of air comes out, and then you'll lose a bit of pressure. But a lot of the time for the lighter riders, that doesn't really make a difference. And you can always kind of compensate with tire pressures. And actually, some different rim combinations can hold tires differently. So there's, as we know with tires and tubular and tubeless, there's a million forms and a million different opinions on it. But it's kind of about researching and chatting to the right people and then just deciding on a setup, I guess.
That's super interesting about why you run tubular in the race, and so I presume do you train on tubeless?
So when we do specific saddle cross training, we train on the race wheels to get that same feeling. But when we train, 90% of my training is on the road, and we train with tubeless road tires. We have great sponsors and we have the kind of best equipment, and that right now is tubeless road tires, and we run the 303s from Zip, which come up really great for tubeless on the road.
Okay, so tubeless is really what I'm trying to guide you down to talk about, because we've had so many questions from our listeners who get so frustrated with tubeless, because you know, tubeless is the future, and yes, it should reduce punctures. And I was out on a ride with Hannah Barnes before the European Championships, and I can't remember if it was Hannah or Alice, but one of them punctured, stopped, spun the puncture to the bottom, sealed it, and then off we went, and it was all fine. But, you know, I know what it's like. I've got a clincher with a tubeless ready tyre, and I know how difficult it can be to get that tubeless ready tyre onto a tubeless ready rim. So what would your advice be for somebody who's concerned about puncturing on a tubeless tyre, not, you know, needing to put a tube in and not being able to get it on the rim or risk of pinching? You know, is it actually down to the tyre? Is it that they're is always a good combination for each kind of tire and rim combination that enable you to be able to flick it on without pinching it and you know, getting out of a sticky spot if you need to?
Yeah, with tubeless, there's loads of different things that come into it. Like, the once you actually do get a puncture, I mean, that's worst case scenario. The idea of kind of moving over to tubeless is to get less punctures. So, and yeah, 9 times out of 10, you will get less punctures. And so you can kind of come with that confidence. From the kind of tire rim combination, I think, say you have a rim that you know you're definitely going to ride, then I think it would be good to research around and find out other people who ride that rim and see what type of tire they ride. Equally, you could do it the other way around. You could find a tire that you really like. Say you have a specific width and model in mind, then you could find the rim combination that people have gotten well with. It's always going to be a bit of trial and error, and some people have bad experiences, some people have good experiences, and there, I'd say there are a few more factors that come into it. And if you do get a puncture, the things that are going to be in your way is getting the tire off the rim, and then making sure you can actually get the valve out as well. I think that's something I've had in mountain bike, is not actually being able to get this, if you want to put a tube in, get this valve out. So always remember to maybe not over tighten your valves too much. But I mean, yeah, ideal scenario is that you run tubeless, and then if the worst happens, you always have a tube, and hopefully your rim tire combination is just fine.
Out of interest, what tyre width and tyre pressure do you run on a standard road ride?
I've been going lower and lower, to be honest, and out here in Girona, the roads are quite shiny, so I've been kind of trying to go as low as possible, really, to get as much grip. So on 20, I think we've got 27 or 28 millimetre tyres on Zip wheels. I can run below 60 psi, 50 to 60 psi, which to kind of more traditionalists would sound ridiculous, but I weigh 60 kilos, and to be honest, I could probably run lower if I was wanting to push it it depends on your circumstances. Like in the winter, there's a lot of rubbish on the road and things like that. So maybe like you don't want to be riding through gravel and big rocks with lower tire pressures. But yeah, it's kind of a trial and error personal thing. There's articles everywhere about kind of these tire pressures and recommended for different people's weights. So it would definitely be to try it. And obviously, worst case scenario is you get it wrong and maybe you get a puncture, but it will improve the quality of your ride if you were to experiment with tire pressures and not just chuck 100 psi in every time.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. My belief is that people run tire pressures way too high, you know, and really that's kind of an old school of thought that people are just kind of stuck in their ways with it. And then, you know, even now if I run 80 in my road tires and, 25s clincher tires, you know, that's actually, it's quite a lot. I don't need that much as someone who's 60 kilos, and you can push it down and down and down, but people kind of think, oh no, you know, you've got to ram it up to 120 PSI. But like you said, out here in Girona on greasy roads, you don't want to be doing that.
And smooth is fast a lot of the time, as we keep getting told. When you're putting out big power, actually having a stable platform to put that through, there's a lot to say for that. So that's another kind of way of thinking about it.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about the importance of tyre choice. Remember back at the Luxembourg World Championships, which I think you reminded me was in 2017, Wout van Aert won. And I remember because it was snowing and it was fine for the women's race because the snow was, it was still cold enough for the snow to still be set. But as all the races went on, the snow got slushier and slushier. And then underneath there were filings or kind of metal. It was an old scrapyard or something. And everybody was puncturing. And the one person who didn't puncture was Wout van Aert, and he won. So I was told back then that it was due to the tyre choice, and he made a very late decision on tyre choice. So can you give us a bit of inside knowledge about that story?
Yeah, so Beals, basically the week leading up to it, I didn't race it, but from what I could see, the ground was kind of frozen solid. So for the junior men's race, it was like an ice rink. It was a crazy race. That was the race where all three British men got a medal with Tom, Dan and Ben, which was pretty historic. But as I say, like, the conditions over the weekend changed massively. So by the last race of the weekend for the elite men, the kind of top layer of dirt had all kind of thawed and melted, and underneath what was coming up was this load of scrap and bricks and all of this. So the main fast ruts were becoming just so dangerous. And as you say, Wout van Aert made a decision, I think it was the night before, to change all of his tires to these old Michelin treads. So Dugast got some old Michelin, the actual tread, and then glued them up on new casings. And it's basically it's a lot more, how to say it, like a solid rubber. It's not a soft compound. So it basically gave him a lot more protection against all these sharp things. And it basically won him world champs. Van der Poel, his team, Cornen Circus, they had 32 punctures in 1 hour of racing.
Oh my God.
And getting to the point when they were having to run back to the team pits area to grab more wheels and more bikes because Van der Poel and his teammates were cracking rims and puncturing every half lap. Any time that Van der Poel made up time, you would see him have to come into the pits with one of his tires being flat. He cried after that race, I think, because he knew that it was an equipment choice and it was kind of out of his hands in the moment, and he lost world champs. So I think it's a good example of how much these things can have a difference. And I'm sure you'll know in the road racing, how one little thing can throw you off, really. 4 hours on the bike, 5 hours on the bike with the wrong tire pressure, the wrong bike setup, it can play with your head as much as anything. And I think that it shows a lot for looking at the details.
It's about planning ahead for the conditions that are gonna come. And I remember this year in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, and it was horrendous weather, or it had been horrendous weather, and it was going to be horrendous weather about halfway through our race. And I knew this because I'd looked in detail at the forecast and it was really obvious to tell what was going to happen, but it was probably wasn't going to happen until about an hour and a half into the race. And, you know, often, you know, the start is really, really fast and then it settles. And then so if you've got a bit in the middle where it's not quite so fast or quite so hard, but it's throwing it down and blowing a gale, you're going to get cold pretty fast. And it was about 4 degrees and there were people on the start line. So this was an equipment choice, but with clothing. There were people in the start line in shorts and short sleeve jerseys, and so many people didn't finish because they were just simply so cold. And so yeah, it's about really planning for those details and planning ahead. And and you can have the same thing with equipment choice. If you know that it's gonna absolutely throw it down in a race and it's really technical, maybe you want to lower your tire pressure, which at the start might be a bit too low, but at the critical point that you need it, it's going to be the correct choice.
And we make those kind of, well, the idea is that we're making those decisions all the time on a race weekend, because the mechanics are always bringing a second option to the pits in the event of rain, in the event of faster conditions. And that is really the kind of difference between, preparing for the worst and all that stuff. Like, yeah, you're hoping that everything's going to be fine, but you need to prepare for the odd scenario that's going to come up.
Well, I think Cameron Morvan answered that. And he's a good talker, isn't he?
Yeah, he's great, but he's even better on the bike. You know, he's done some seriously impressive stuff this season. You know, third in the European Cyclocross Championships and only stopped in his tracks by a broken collarbone. But he's coming back, and I think it's really great that he'll be able to get back for the World Championships. And, you know, that's obviously the really big target of the season. And it is a shame because the cyclocross season is so short and it's so compact. And so if you do have an injury, you miss so much of it. But, you know, he's already had one fantastic result. And the talent in British cyclocross at the moment is just absolutely phenomenal.
It is. And do you know what? I mean, I've had my eye on it for a while and it's just, I mean, even now it's just starting to bubble through. You know, Pidcock's had another, he seems to have breakthrough results all the time. He's had another one. I mean, it'd be interesting going forward. I mean, is cyclocross going to be the new... I mean, it used to be going through the GB track programme was like the route to being the best on the road. I mean, maybe cyclocross is the new route to that. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, for sure. And like, it's definitely a route to inspire loads of people to get on their bikes, and especially young people, because all of these cyclocross stars, they're all real young guns and they've got a whole career ahead of them. And they're chipping away at podiums all the time now, and just think what they can achieve in 5-10 years time. And, you know, maybe in the future we'll even see cyclocross being included in the Olympics. I mean, that would be really cool. It's such a great spectator sport. I just think, why not?
I'm going to let you go, Lizzie. And hopefully when we speak again... I was going to say, hopefully we'll be in the same country. I don't know if I hope for that, to be honest. Wherever you are, Lizzie, it'll be great to speak to you. I will have fed your cats, if that's what you need me to do. And have a happy Christmas.
Thanks, Tom. Merry Christmas to you. And I think I'm going to spend the next week trialling whether a mince pie really is a good option or not in the back pocket, because I don't believe it is, but I think it should be investigated.
I don't believe there's a single mince pie in Girona. I'm going to say it. I don't think there's a single one there.
Well, I think you're wrong because there's three in this flat. There's only three because three have already been eaten. But there are definitely mince pies in Girona, and I'm not sure whether or not I'm going to put them in my pocket. I might just eat them tonight.